Lee said prosecutors should have charged other officers who opened fire as well.
They should have someone held responsible for it. But there's two people dead, and the one person that they say should have been responsible is walking the street just like me and you.
But another case here may draw greater attention. The fatal shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice by a Cleveland officer last November. It's one of several police incidents still under investigation in Cleveland. Last year, Tanisha Anderson, a woman with mental illness, died as officers took her into custody. Her family has sued the city. Also last year, a Justice Department report cited police here for a pattern and practice of using unreasonable force. The city is now negotiating reforms. At the end of the Eastside protest, Shantaya McCurdy said she hopes those reforms will yield a police department that better knows the neighbors it serves.
You relate to those people when something bad does happen, they feel safe and feel okay talking to you about it. But as long as that us against them attitude, you'll never get nowhere with them because the people that are good and bad fear the police.
Downtown last night, the number of people attending the Cavaliers-Hawks playoff game far outnumbered the handful of protesters who tried to block traffic just outside. The gathering of fans included those who feel police deserve more credit for their work. While more demonstrations could happen this week, many here appear grateful that an atmosphere of nonviolence has prevailed as the city continues to wrestle with major contentious issues between residents and the police. For NPR News, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
Next, a story where religion and sports collide. Runners usually have routes they like and others they avoid. That becomes much tougher if you're a woman in a conservative society where some oppose women running in sports gear. That's why one Palestinian woman, an Arab citizen of Israel, prefers to jog in Jewish areas. Recently, she tried organizing a race in her own town and faced threats. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
It's race day in the Israeli beach town of Netanya. Runner Hanin Radi rounds up the girls she coaches and brought here today. Her young runners are excited. 15-year-old Mais Bashara is about to run her first 10K. She joined Radi's club a few months ago and she loves it.
It's so exciting and I feel so good when I run.
They all came from Tira, an Arab Israeli town, a half an hour drive inland. But Bashara says the team doesn't run there.
We try to run in Tira, but no results for this. They don't want us to run in Tira.
Who they are is part of this story, which starts with Hanin Radi, the girl's coach, and her dream of promoting running in her community. She tells me about this back in Tira.
We decided 3 months ago to organize a marathon here in my own town to bring health, to bring something really good to my own people, sports.
But not everyone liked the idea.
Certain people came to the municipality over here and said, they said, you can do a marathon, but just for males, not for females. No, I said, no. You cannot put women aside. They have to participate.
Threats were made to disrupt the race. Then someone shot Radi's car when it was parked outside her home.
I didn't feel really afraid when I heard the threat. But when they shot my car, I felt really afraid.
Opinion in town was split. An 80-year-old woman sitting outside her dress shop said women runners would have to cover up. Shorts or tank tops were unacceptable. A middle-aged fruit vendor blamed bearded men he described as crazy. He meant Muslim religious leaders. But devout Muslims were also divided. Outside a mosque, Rashad Fetheli, a member of a political Islamic group, said he opposed a co-ed marathon.
Our religion tells us to take care of our girls' honor, so we won't let them go out and let boys look at them.
Inside, the man who calls others to pray five times a day, Rashid Mansour, said he had no problem with women running in sports clothes in public.
When we go to Tel Aviv or the beach, we see people in different clothing and nothing happens.
More than 100 people rallied in Tira shortly after the shooting to support Hanin Radi and her hope to hold a marathon. Radi says she wants to keep promoting running.
I'm happy, I'm smiling. A lot of things to the better in my life, the fact that I'm running.
But the threats changed things too. Now she doesn't want to take the lead in organizing the race. Tira resident Asma Khoury does no sports herself, but she hopes Haneen Rahti won't give up.
They want to frighten her. They want her to be scared to stop doing that. I hope she's not going to stop. We need her to be strong because she brought something new to Tira, and we are very proud of her.
Police questioned one suspect in the shooting and let him go. Some city officials say they hope to host a marathon open to all, but there is no date set. Emily Harris, NPR News, Tira, Israel.
And on this Memorial Day, let's reflect on the meaning of the holiday. Carmela Lasbada is a longtime advocate for veterans. Back in 1996, she talked with a group of kids visiting Washington, D.C.
And I said, you know, Memorial Day is next Monday. And I said, do you know what the meaning of Memorial Day is, what it's all about? And they all looked at each other. And in unison, they said, oh, that's the day the swimming pool's open.
Lasbada was worried adults were also losing sight of the day's true purpose, to honor those killed while serving in the armed forces. So she asked Congress to establish a national moment of remembrance, which it ultimately did. The idea is to stop whatever you are doing for a quiet moment of reflection at 3 p.m. local time.
As we come to the 3 o'clock hour, all the fans are to their feet. All of the flags have been lowered to half-mast.
NASCAR has its drivers pull over mid-race. Major League Baseball pauses its games, and Amtrak trains blow their whistles. For many, it's a more private moment.
I am Howard Rittenbaugh, a national coordinator for Bugles Across America.
His organization sends buglers to play taps for free at military funerals.
I make sure that prior to 3 p.m., I am on the highest spot in Riverview Cemetery up above Huntingdon, Pennsylvania. And I stand there and I wait for the church bells to finish pealing the hour at 3. I sound taps, I salute, and I walk away.
He says he usually performs this ritual alone, but one year he noticed a couple watching him.
The lady said, it's a shame there aren't more people to hear that. And I said, well, I really don't do it for the people that might be able to stand here to hear this. I do it for these, and I kind of wave my arm out across, indicating the hundreds of flag-adorned grave markers that were surrounding us.
That's Howard Rittenbaugh, one of many who will be marking the national moment of remembrance this Memorial Day at 3 o'clock this afternoon, wherever you are. This is NPR News.
18 past 8 on Memorial Day. Good morning, I'm Michael Leland on Wisconsin Public Radio. More than 500,000 Americans will rack up drug bills this year, exceeding $50,000, and more new drugs for diseases like cancer or hepatitis C are priced above that point for a year's supply. We'll have a report coming up in about 20 minutes. Clouds and rain showers likely across the state this morning. Slight chance of thunderstorms as well. Temperatures mainly in the 60s today.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
Have a little shindig on the terrace rooftop sponsored by Wollersheim Winery. Me and the boys in the band will be there having brats and more, and you can join us in celebrating 30 years of Not Much. Tickets and details at notmuch.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. An Iranian negotiator says UN inspectors might be allowed to inspect Iranian military sites as part of a final nuclear agreement. NPR's Peter Kenyon says this contradicts an earlier hardline position.
Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, a senior nuclear negotiator, says the Iranian side is not objecting to managed access for nuclear inspections in or around military sites. Iranian officials stress that the access would be tightly controlled and would not reveal any of Iran's, quote, military secrets. U.S. officials insist on inspections to verify that Iran keeps its commitments.
The U.S. is hoping to reach a final nuclear deal with Iran by the end of June. Some people in Oakland, California say they oppose the mayor's new restrictions on demonstrators aimed at curbing violence and property damage. They ban nighttime protests and force protesters from the streets onto sidewalks. Four people were arrested and nearly 20 others were cited by police yesterday. Rachel Lederman is a civil rights attorney who plans a legal challenge.
The police have really drastically changed their policy over the last few nights, and this actually violates a federal court order, and we're going to be seeking to reverse that.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News. I'm Washington.
And I'm Michael Leland with Wisconsin Public Radio News. The Wisconsin Parents Association is criticizing the way state lawmakers have approved a motion letting private, homeschooled, and online charter students take part in public school activities and athletics. WPA Executive Director Larry Casement points out the late addition was made in what he calls a sneaky fashion, passing it without discussion at about 1:30 in the morning. The bill's sponsor, State Representative Bob Culp, had reached out last February to see how the association would feel about the change. Caseman told the Stratford Republican that his group would oppose it because it fears it could lead to increased government controls on homeschooled students, something those parents do not want. Milwaukee police are investigating three separate shootings that occurred in a 21-minute period late Saturday night. One man was killed and four others hurt. 23-year-old fatality victim was shot in front of a home around 11:37. On Saturday night, 4 minutes later, a 25-year-old man was shot. He told police that he was just walking down the street at the time. A man has died after becoming trapped in a fiery pickup truck in Racine County. Authorities say the incident happened after a crash Sunday on Highway 75 in the town of Kansasville. The driver of a sport utility vehicle had fallen asleep and drifted into the lane of the pickup truck that was pulling a trailer. The driver of the pickup truck was forced into a ditch and became trapped before his vehicle caught fire. Racine County Sheriff's Office says deputies arrived to find the truck engulfed in flames. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. From RDO, offering RDO Select, a subscription plan where mobile users can listen to music stations and download 25 songs to listen to anytime. Learn more at rdio.com/select. From Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. Oscar Romero moved one step closer to sainthood over the weekend. The late Archbishop from El Salvador was beloved for his defense of the poor. In 1980, as the country's civil war began, Romero was shot and killed. His beatification this weekend brought forth an outpouring of devotion across El Salvador, but it also exposed political and religious differences that still run deep. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
It was 35 years ago that a right-wing assassin drove his car up this driveway in the small cancer hospital complex where I'm standing right now, rolled down his window and shot one bullet through the broad doorway and into the heart of Monsignor Oscar Romero, who was saying mass at the complex's small chapel. Hallelujah. Yesterday, the church, which 3 decades ago was the flashpoint of the deep divisions in the country, overflowed with Romero faithful. Many attending wore T-shirts emblazoned with the priest's serene smile. A huge portrait of him surrounded by bright paper flowers was perched next to the altar. Oscar Diaz says the country is ecstatic over the long overdue official recognition of Romero's work.
Creo que esto, había pasado ya mucho tiempo para que se diera esto.
It was a worthwhile wait for his beatification, says Diaz. For decades, Romero's supporters' push for sainthood met with stiff resistance from conservative forces in El Salvador and in the Catholic Church. They had labeled Romero's defense of the poor and outspokenness as subversive and political. It wasn't until Pope Francis declared Romero was killed out of hatred for his faith not because of his politics, that the path to beatification was cleared. But it seems that neither the Pope's intervention nor the countrywide celebration can close El Salvador's long and deep political divisions. Across town at one of the country's most conservative churches, the pews are full. There are no references to Romero here. Just one small poster of the priest hangs inside. Armed guards wander the manicured lawns around the church's parking lot filled with BMWs and Audis. Parishioner Anna Corrales says she respects the Pope's decision, but says politicians here continue to manipulate Romero's image and words. I thought his message was that we should all love each other and not about keeping the classes separate. She's referring to the current government run by the FMLN, Ferdinando Martí National Liberation Front. The former Marxist fighters won the presidency for the first time in 2009. We need to ask God for them to get the idea of revolution and war out of their heads, interjects her husband, Roberto Corrales. At Saturday's beatification celebration held at the capital's iconic Savior of the World traffic circle, more than 200,000 people were estimated in the crowd that spilled down several streets. While conservatives objected to busloads of FMLN supporters being bused in from around the country, others complained about the VIP list. Sitting in chairs in the roped-off front rows closest to the stage were some of Monsignor Romero's staunchest political enemies, including the son of the man widely accused of masterminding the priest's murder.
Dicen que el criminal siempre vuelve a la escena del crimen.
They say the criminal always returns to the scene of the crime, says Daniel Delgado, a defense lawyer who watched the ceremony on a big screen TV set up in the street a few blocks down from the main stage. He says he hopes the rite's attendance means they feel bad about their past actions and are ready to work with the government to make El Salvador safer and more prosperous for everyone. Kerry Khan, NPR News, San Salvador.
The legacy of Oscar Romero is strongly linked to liberation theology, a left-leaning view of the church's role in society. For more on that controversial movement, we spoke to Boston Globe religion editor John Allen, who traveled to San Salvador for the beatification.
Liberation theology was a movement in Catholic thought that arose in Latin America in the late 50s, early 60s, and was basically born by a group of Catholic thinkers who were looking at the social reality of Latin America, which at the time was defined largely by crushing poverty and the domination of both wealth and political power by a very thin veneer of social elites, and who drew the conclusion that that was not the gospel vision of how life ought to work. And so they began pressing the Catholic Church to stand on the side of the poor. It became a very controversial movement. It also became controversial in the Vatican, where there was concerns that it was overly given to relying on Marxist analysis and that it ended up blessing violence. And so titanic battles were fought. And so the kind of rehabilitation that has been going on under Pope Francis, all of that has been seen widely in the church as healing old wounds.
Those old wounds in El Salvador especially have to do with Archbishop Romero and his assassination. You have called him a hero of the liberation theology movement. Would you call him a follower of that movement?
No, I think he was someone who tried to transcend the division between the liberation theology crowd and the more traditional spiritual crowd. However, as the symbol of Romero has played out in the 35 years since his death, I think it is fair to say that Archbishop Romero is seen as a great hero and an icon by the progressive, socially involved wing of the Catholic Church, and yet to this day is seen with some ambivalence by the more conservative wing of the church.
And what about Pope Francis? He is not, I would say, an advocate of liberation theology exactly, but he has definitely made a turn from his predecessor, Pope Benedict.
You're right to say that Pope Francis is not himself, and nor has he ever been, identified as a liberation theologian. In fact, back in the 1970s, when he was the leader of the Jesuit order in Argentina, he was sometimes seen as an enemy of liberation theology. But on the other hand, I think what this beatification in Pope Francis's mind, what it says is that the main thrust of what Romero stood for and the main thrust of what the liberation theologians stood for, which is the quest of the poor for justice, was right, and he wants it to be the official policy of the Universal Catholic Church in his time.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Allen covers the Vatican for the Boston Globe. We spoke with him in San Salvador, where he covered the beatification of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero. And this is NPR News.
Remember the Maine. That battle cry of 1898 rallied Americans to war against Spain. It was heard especially loud and clear in a tiny Indiana city.
Yeah, these guys were definitely independent. They were out to save the world, these guys.
And a piece of those troops' legacy still stands in their hometown. That story on Memorial Day on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered begins at 3 this afternoon on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. A girl in Italy was celebrating her 9th birthday and she wanted a My Little Pony cake. Apparently, the pastry shop there in Sicily misheard the order. So instead of a bright pink pony with a flowing blue mane, Evelina got a bouffant-haired singer in a glittery jacket. Little Tony. The Elvis doppelganger was semi-famous in 1960s Britain. A very upset little Evelina had never heard of him. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come this half hour, John Forbes Mass Jr., the Nobel laureate known for his groundbreaking work on game theory and differential equations, was killed with his wife in a taxi accident in New Jersey over the weekend. He is best known to most of us as the subject of the 2001 film A Beautiful Mind. We'll hear more about his life coming up in about 15 minutes. We also checked the day's business news at 10 minutes before 9 o'clock this morning.
Support for WPR comes from Motorless Motion Bicycles, dedicated to the continuous restoration of Madison's historic railroad depot, featuring Cannondale, Salsa, and Gunner brands. More at motorlessmotionbicycles.com.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4, and it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition. Up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen every weekday.
We have a rainy start to Memorial Day across much of the state. Heaviest rain right now falling in central Wisconsin, although there is rain in northeast Wisconsin, northwest Wisconsin, southeast Wisconsin. That'll continue pretty much throughout the morning hours anyway, and there's a chance of rain in northern Wisconsin this afternoon. Temperatures today mainly in the 60s. Right now in Superior, it's 47 degrees. Eau Claire, 61. Wausau, 59 degrees. Milwaukee, 64. In Green Bay, it is 63. In La Crosse, 65 degrees.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Living Essentials, maker of 5-Hour Energy. Available in cherry flavor with the red, white, and blue bottle and supporting Special Operations Warriors Foundation. From the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, the escalating cost of prescription drugs. Over 500,000 Americans racked up drug bills last year that exceeded $50,000. More and more, a year's supply of new drugs can be even pricier. That's the case for drugs to treat multiple sclerosis. NPR's Richard Harris has more.
Portland, Oregon resident Barbara Headke once lived the athletic life that the city is known for.
I used to do crazy things. I used to be a crazy rollerblader, and we do like 25-mile rollerblades, and, you know, I used to be a big, huge biker.
But more than 15 years ago, she inexplicably started losing strength in one leg.
during a 6-week period, I went from being able to walk normally to having a difficult time walking a block.
Doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. Her strength mostly returned, but then she got another ominous symptom.
In 2001, then I had an issue with my eye where I had a difficult time seeing it. Sort of the eye became darker, and then I was diagnosed officially then.
She had multiple sclerosis, a degenerative disease that interferes with nerve impulses. Her type is a variety that comes and goes over the years. She started taking a drug which cost about $10,000 a year. Insurance covered most of that until the economy turned sour and she and her husband found themselves both looking for work.
We were in the hole, and so $10,000 was a lot of money. I mean, under the best circumstances, it's a lot of money, but then particularly it was really difficult.
The drug maker offered her the medicine at no cost until she once again had health insurance. And then, as the years rolled by, she watched as the price of her medicine simply went through the roof.
It went up almost 3 times in that 10-year time frame.
That's an increase of 30% a year, every single year, for the exact same product. She recently switched drugs, and the new one costs even more.
This is the drug. $5,500 worth of drug right here in this little bottle.
And that's a 1-month supply. A year of this medication costs $66,000. The drug company isn't sticking her with the bill, though. She's grateful that the company has excused co-payments that could cost her thousands of dollars. But those huge drug bills are typically shouldered by co-workers who end up with higher health insurance premiums. Even the oldest drugs for MS are priced at this level now, according to a recent study in the journal Neurology.
Despite more choices, prices just continue to rise. So yeah, contrary to kind of what you would think would happen.
Daniel Hartung and his colleagues at Oregon State and the Oregon Health and Sciences University decided to dig into the economics of MS drugs. There are now 12 drugs on the market to treat this disease, and they are all really expensive. And unlike other fields where competition drives down prices, the rules of supply and demand don't apply here. Some cost 6 times more than they did when they hit the market in the 1990s.
We pay more, substantially more than what is paid in Canada, Australia, and the UK, and often 2 to 3 times more than what those countries are able to negotiate directly.
Drug companies have often argued that they have to set the price high to recoup the expense of developing a challenging and risky drug in the first place.
Those arguments do kind of lose a lot of their credibility when you talk about these medications that have been on the market for 20 years or so. I mean, they've made their money many fold over probably on these agents.
So what's going on here? Stephen Schondelmeyer is a pharmaceutical economist at the University of Minnesota. He wasn't involved in the MS study, but he has studied drug pricing for many years.
These companies were acting much like a OPEC or a cartel, knowing that if we all keep moving up and nobody moves down, we can get away with raising price because if a person has MS, multiple sclerosis, what other choice do they have?
This situation is a bit different from the $80,000 price tag for a new class of drugs for hepatitis C. At least those drugs cure the patient and reduce future healthcare costs. Not so for the rapidly rising costs of existing drugs to treat MS.
When the price of a drug doubles, does the patient get twice as much outcome? No, it's the same drug.
And expensive new drugs are becoming increasingly common, not just for neurological diseases, but for cancer as well, Schondelmeyer notes, as the drug industry remains one of the most profitable businesses on the planet.
Sometimes the drug companies talk about a death spiral down if they compete on prices. I think we've entered the period of the death spiral upward, that the prices being set for drugs are so high that literally the pricing committee of a drug company becomes the death panel that people were afraid of under Obamacare.
The pharmaceutical industry's trade group disputes that, saying that inflation in drugs is about the same as medical inflation overall, mostly because cheaper generic drugs are replacing widely used brand name products. Lori Riley at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America also takes issue with the drug prices used in the Oregon study. It looked at list prices.
When you're only looking at the list price and you're not looking at the significant rebates and discounts that go on, it's really not an apples-to-apples comparison.
Insurance companies cut deals with the drug companies, so it's hard to know how much people are actually paying. And she says drug prices aren't simply based on what it takes for companies to recoup past investments.
The revenue that a company derives year in over year out, you know, is also paying for future research. Obviously, we know in the MS space that the medicines that exist on the market today don't cure the disease. A lot of the companies that are currently in the MS space that have medicines on the market are using that revenue to reinvest for future innovation. And that innovation is costly.
Back in Portland, Barbara Hedke has heard that argument before, and she understands it. But still,
to have to think about cost continually going up so that I can help fund the research. You know, on the one hand, I'm grateful. On the other hand, I'm upset, you know?
Hedke really appreciates that the drug company has left her off the hook for thousands of dollars of copays that she could have been hit with. Still, the expense makes her uneasy.
It's always a stress because every year I also have to renew the copay program with them. And I don't know that they're going to continue to cover me.
And she says that stress surely can't be helpful as she tries to keep her MS under control. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Novo Nordisk with ActForDiabetes.com, an advocacy tool for patients with diabetes and others affected by diabetes. More at ActForDiabetes.com. And from Athena Health, cloud-based services for medical groups and health systems to help physicians work as one across the continuum of care. AthenaHealth.com.
This is NPR News.
It's 19 before 9 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Michael Leland. The markets are closed today because of the Memorial Day holiday, but there is business news, and we'll check it coming up in about 10 minutes. On the Marketplace Morning Report this morning, when lower fuel prices translate to big savings for airline companies, what are the airlines doing with all that extra money? We'll hear that coming up in a little less than 10 minutes. Cloudy with showers across Wisconsin this morning and a slight chance of a thunderstorm as well.
Did you know you can donate your old vehicle to support Wisconsin Public Radio? We'll use the proceeds to bring you all the programs you love, and you get a tax deduction. Your old ride could bring you tomorrow's news stories and provide CDs for our music library. It's free, fast, and easy. Go to WPR.org/support to find out more. And thanks.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Taliban are claiming responsibility for today's truck bombing in southern Afghanistan. At least 5 people were killed and more than 60 others wounded. The attack occurred in Zabul province near the Pakistan border at the entrance to a provincial compound. In Tunisia, 7 soldiers were killed today when a fellow soldier opened fire at a military base that was in the capital. The shooter was later killed. At least 10 others were wounded. It's the day after local elections in Spain. Voters dealt defeat to the country's ruling conservatives. As Lauren Freyer reports from Madrid, 2 upstart parties won power in city halls and regional parliaments across Spain.
It'll be a new era of multi-party politics in Spain. 2 new parties on the left and center-right have made inroads at the expense of ruling conservatives. They've lost their absolute majorities in most Spanish regions. The new winners include an anti-evictions protester who's been elected as Barcelona's new mayor.
Jazz trumpeter Marcus Belgrave has died. A relative says Belgrave died of heart failure in Michigan at the age of 78. He performed with music legends such as Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, and Dizzy Gillespie. Belgrave was just 12 years old when he joined the Ray Charles Band. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
I'm Michael Leland with Wisconsin Public Radio News. A lack of grant money means police departments in Appleton and other cities in Wisconsin are affecting special traffic enforcement efforts like the current Click It or Ticket campaign. Unlike in the past, no officers have been specifically assigned to the program. The numbers reveal the effect in Appleton. In 2012 and 13, more than 7,400 citations were written for people who weren't buckled up. Last year, that number fell by more than 20%. Authorities in Columbia County are using sonar to try to find the body of a 21-year-old Chicago man who disappeared in the Wisconsin River near the Wisconsin Dells. Authorities say the man went underwater around 7:15 Saturday evening while swimming to shore. He did not resurface. Divers from the Columbia County Sheriff's Office worked till midnight to find the man. Search efforts resumed on Sunday morning. The incident happened in the Lower Dells, a few hundred yards south of the dam. A 32-year-old mother who was shot on the Trestle Trail Bridge in Menasha 3 weeks ago has now been released from the hospital and returned home to recover. Aaron Stoffel was critically wounded in a random shooting incident. 33-year-old John Stoffel, 11-year-old Olivia Stoffel, and 31-year-old Amanda Bentall of Appleton were all killed. Adam Bentall, rather. The 27-year-old gunman, Sergio Daniel Valencia, killed himself. Investigators say Aaron Stoffel managed to get two of her children to safety, even though she had been wounded three times. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Michael Leland.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Athena Health, cloud-based EHR and practice management services for medical groups and health systems to help physicians work as one across the continuum of care. More at athenahealth.com. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is in appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. A country artist once said all he needed to write a song were three chords and the truth. To succeed these days, he might also need a bunch of social media accounts. The internet allows artists to gain a following by essentially inviting fans into their living rooms. Emily Siner from member station WPLN reports that those fans sometimes overstay their welcome.
Olivia Francis is sitting in an armchair in her Nashville apartment, hunched over a laptop. Francis is 18 years old. She moved to Nashville last summer to propel her music career. She's outgoing and bubbly and has dived into the music business with a so far undeterred enthusiasm. Part of that means immersing herself in social media.
I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, Vine.
Standard YouTube, stuff for a teenager Spotify, these days. But wait, there's more.
Bandcamp, Broadjam, Music X-Ray, Hit License, Google Play, Reverb Nation, and of course iTunes. And it's so hard to keep track of them all.
Frances is far from the only aspiring singer-songwriter to spend a lot of time on social media. Big numbers online mean more fans to see your shows and maybe get the attention of a label. It's a big change from the pre-digital music days.
If somebody didn't like believe in you and said, oh, we don't think this is going to work on a label, then you were pretty much done. Then you were a lounge singer, right?
Charles Alexander is a Nashville digital strategist for musicians.
What's beautiful about this time is that if your music is something that you believe in, you have so many tools and platforms at your disposal to sort of get the word out relatively inexpensively.
Frances hasn't had any big payoff yet from promoting her stuff online, but she enjoys cultivating fans and talking to them, which has recently led to an unexpected side effect. There are fans who enjoy talking to her a little too much.
You're telling me something like, well, I'm going to the dentist today because I have a surgery I have to go to. Sometimes it feels like there aren't really any boundaries anymore.
Then there was the middle-aged man who messaged her incessantly on Facebook.
You know, the questions he was asking and what he was telling me about his personal life, I thought were just a little too personal for someone who I really don't know except through social media.
Frances says many of her female peers have the same kinds of interactions with doting male fans, and she can't really ignore them, she says, because at this point in her career, she needs all the fans she can get. So she's been trying to gently cut off their conversation sooner, but she says she's not going to stop posting about her life on social media. That includes a songwriting session in her living room with a Nashville guitarist. They're working on some new music. When it's over, she pulls out her iPhone to take a selfie.
Okay. Here we go.
For NPR News, I'm Emily Siner in Nashville.
And now, a remembrance. The mathematician and Nobel laureate John Nash has died. He and his wife, Alicia, were killed in a car crash over the weekend. Nash's struggle with schizophrenia inspired the Oscar-winning film A Beautiful Mind.
I was disturbed in this way for a very long period of time, like 25 years. The movie gives an insight into how this sort of thing can go.
That's John Nash in 2004. He is best known for his work in game theory, considered one of the most influential economic ideas of the 20th century.
I don't think exactly like a professional economist. I think about economics and economic ideas, but somewhat like an outsider.
When they died, John and Alicia Nash were returning from Norway, where he received a mathematics prize. He was 86 years old. This is NPR News.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. We'll check the business news from the Marketplace Morning Report in just a moment. Later today on All Things Considered, the battle cry of 1898, Remember the Maine, rallied Americans to war against Spain. It was heard especially loud and clear in an Indiana city. Military volunteers from that town left behind a legacy that remains today. We'll hear more on that and the day's news headlines from All Things Considered beginning at 3 this afternoon on WPR.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the annual Aging Well Conference will take place Friday, June 5th at UW Parkside. The conference is full of good information for those in a caregiving role or those who work with the elderly. Visit uwp.edu/ce.
The songs will appear on the screen, and the host for the evening will teach everyone the hand jive. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support film and fun. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
It'll be mostly cloudy with rain showers around Wisconsin this morning. There's a slight chance of a thunderstorm as well. Chance of rain in the northern part of the state this afternoon. Temperatures mainly in the 60s, bit cooler near the Great Lakes. Superior right now at 47 degrees. Eau Claire, 62. It is 63 in Green Bay, 64 in Milwaukee, 65 in La Crosse. Madison right now, 67.
Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, offering arts-related activities, outdoor recreation, and craft brewing in the center of Wisconsin. More at StevensPointArea.com.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Become a professionally trained truck driver in just 5 weeks and get job placement assistance. Courses for the Class A CDL license are held in Kenosha year-round. Also upgrade from a B to an A license in just 2 weeks. Visit gtc.edu.
Asian stocks sprint while most of the world takes a breather.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Angie's List with reviews of local companies to help users buy services and achieve their goals of remodeled kitchens, freshly painted houses, or new backyards. AngiesList.com. And by the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business, where critical thinking and hands-on learning are at the core of the curriculum. More at SmithEffect.com.
From APM in New York, I'm Matt Nesto, sitting in for David Brancaccio. It's Memorial Day, and markets in the U.S. are, of course, closed, as are exchanges in London and Germany, thanks to a generically labeled bank holiday. That said, markets in Europe that are open for business are generally weaker today as concerns about a Greek default continue to limit progress in that region. But those concerns aren't impacting Asia, where stocks in China and Japan both surged to fresh multi-year highs. We asked BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker to explain exactly what's going on in Asia's top two economies.
Investors in both of Asia's two largest economies found something to welcome in today's trading. In Tokyo, the rise was a continuation of a longer-term upward trend, which in turn reflects the hope that the economy is gaining strength, a kind of bet on Abenomics, the strategy named after the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The Nikkei has more than doubled since late 2012, although it's still little more than half the peak it reached going into Japan's financial crisis a quarter of a century ago. The rise in share prices in China was led by infrastructure and transport companies after the state planning agency released a list of 1,000 projects for which it's inviting private sector help to fund, build and operate. The index has gained strongly in the last year, despite the fact that the country's economic growth is slowing markedly.
You surely noticed gasoline prices inching back up over the past few months. Even so, they're still down more than 27% or a buck a gallon from Memorial Day a year ago. While pleasing to motorists, that decline pales compared to the slump in jet fuel prices, which have fallen more than 40% in the past year. So what are airlines doing with all those savings? Marketplace's Sabri Benishur fills us in.
Airlines may have saved up to $22 billion in fuel costs over the past year. And if you were hoping to see some of that in the form of cheaper tickets, well, get in line, because the airlines aren't boarding your group yet.
They're putting that money back into the business in the form of new planes, new services.
Jean Medina is a spokesperson for industry group Airlines for America. She says that airlines are carrying about $60 billion in debt they need to service, too. Another priority group for fuel savings, at least for some airlines, is labor.
Delta, a couple months ago, made the largest profit-sharing payout in history to their workers.
Samuel Engel manages the aviation practice at ICF International. And as for ticket prices...
As the fuel prices come down, it starts to allow airlines to compete against each other and offer discounts, but it's not immediate. It doesn't happen until the competitive dynamic plays out.
So, no, fuel prices are not going to save us a ton on plane tickets just yet, but that's cute that we thought that. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to explore the next generation of targeted therapies for many cancers. Videos, white papers, and patient stories are available at discovercarebelieve.org.
And finally, carnivores take note. A group of Harvard engineering students have swapped their books for the barbecue and are on a quest to invent a better way to smoke ribs and brisket and the like. After partnering with Williams-Sonoma and testing more than 200 pounds of meat, the Smart Smoker Project is delivering some delicious results. New England Public Radio's Susan Kaplan sinks her teeth into this story.
It wasn't hard to find the class. The mosquito aroma led me right to teaching assistant Peyton Neesmith. The Alabama native is tending a 300-pound black hourglass-shaped ceramic smoker. The contraption is covered with wires, gadgets, and gizmos.
This brisket has been cooking since 3 a.m. We probably have a few hours left on it. This is our typical routine, our cadence of our battle rhythm, as our advisor would say.
That advisor is Professor Kevin Kit Parker. He's not just an academic. He's a towering Army Lieutenant Colonel in the Reserves, and he has a Southerner's passion for barbecue.
Now, I was walking around the parking lot of the Memphis Liberty Bowl, looking at all these contraptions that people were smoking barbecue in, and I'm thinking, none of these things looks the same. And that means we haven't reduced our knowledge of barbecue down to a fundamental set of laws about how to do barbecue right.
Parker vetted his ideas with culinary experts.
I talked to some classically trained chefs. They said, hey, no one's done this. No one's ever taken a scientific approach to barbecue, to smoking.
Parker teaches bioengineering and applied physics at Harvard, so he decided to give his students a real-world assignment. First, he introduced them to a client, the high-end consumer retailer Williams-Sonoma. The job, come up with the perfect smoker. After five long, snowy months, the data is in.
How they examined the problem and how they went through the whole engineering design algorithm.
It's game day.
Oh, and the samples.
We only take honest opinions.
It's really good.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we eat with our hands.
The students worked up to the last minute to showcase the final product. A parade of guests check it out in a fancy auditorium in one of Harvard's engineering buildings. Professors, chefs, and top brass from Williams-Sonoma packed the room. The students rock.
My name is Sujay Tile, and on behalf of...
And I'm going to introduce the last feature of the hyperboloid cooling tile we have that we think
all
is very
16 play a part in explaining the smoker's intricacies using Parker's mantra, design, build, test. As he chews, Williams-Sonoma's Pat Connolly rates the Harvard smoker against other smokers out there.
Well, if you look at the color, the final color... You know, you get a much more consistent color here. If you look at the moisture is fantastic here compared to the competition. And the flavor, both are good. This is better.
Connolly says the trademarked, patent-pending, app-wielding BBIQ smart smoker just might have the right stuff and make the leap from the classroom to a future Memorial Day celebration. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm Susan Kaplan for Marketplace.
If you want to see more of the science behind the Smart Smoker, we have a mouth-watering montage available on our website, marketplace.org. Several pictures there behind the scenes. You can also follow us on Twitter anytime you'd like. We are at Marketplace. In New York, I'm Matt Nesto with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you can hear the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday as part of Morning Edition here on WPR. And for a complete look at the day's business news and a market update on market open days, join us for Marketplace. That's tonight and every weeknight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered.
Support for WPR comes from Steep & Brew, a Wisconsin coffee roaster dedicated to delivering truly fresh, premium coffee to local grocers. Coffee roasted today is delivered within 72 hours. Steep & Brew, coffee done right. More at steepandbrew.com.
Support for WGTD and NPR in Walworth County comes from Broggy Coffee House and Wine Bar, Highway 67 and Walworth Avenue in Williams Bay, live music, art and music classes, local arts and crafts, and homemade specialty dishes. BroggyCoffeeWineMusicArt.com.
You're listening to W.